From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 18th day of February 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas. And Eric Snodgrass from Nutrient Ag Solutions in Dagrable will join us to discuss the agricultural weather forecast for the growing regions across the planet. By the way, Eric and Mike will both join us at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana for the Spring Outlook coming up on Tuesday, the 8th day of March. You can too. It's easy to do. WillAg.org to get your tickets today. Register now online at WILLAG.org or call during regular business hours at 217-333-7300.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
By the way, if you're listening to this live Friday afternoon during the 2 o'clock hour Central Time, President Biden will be addressing the nation as it relates to the military troop buildup on the Ukrainian border by the Russians. Because this is important to the agricultural community, I've embedded a live player into the WillAg.org website. You'll see that pop up at about 10 minutes to the hour of 3 o'clock Central Time, and you'll be able to watch President Biden's address on our website at WillAg.org. That's WILLAG.org. March corn for the day settled at 6.54 and a quarter. It was up 4 and a quarter. The May at 6.52 and 3 quarters, 3 and a half higher. And December corn up 1 and a quarter at 5.97 and 3 quarters. March soybeans, $6 a penny and a half, up 9 and a half. And November new crop at 14.63 and 3 quarters, 3 higher. Bean meal futures at 4.47.90, down $1.30. Bean oil for the day, 76 cents higher. And wheat futures were a penny lower at $7.97 on the afternoon. Live cattle futures in Chicago finished the lead down 90 cents. Feeder cattle were 77 and a half lower, and the lean hogs were up $1.82 and a half. Mike Zuzulo of GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas is now here. Good afternoon to you, Michael. Thanks for being with us. Looking forward to having you at the Beef House in March.
I'm already getting excited for those delicious rolls and cheeseburgers, Todd.
You bet. That Beef House lunch, the Beef House breakfast, the rolls and coffee, that is, in the morning, are awfully good. $25 online, willag.org, to get yourself registered, or 217-333-7300. We've been talking for more than a month, Mike, about Ukraine and Russia and the impact it's had and continues to have on the commodity markets. It appears that something there may happen today through the weekend, and the markets are closed on Monday. Does this, I don't know how this makes you feel. It's got to be a little scary going into the weekend.
Well, it is, because, you know, the trade, I think, as we've talked about, Todd, the trade, I think, would feel a lot more easily resolved if the military conflict would occur, that would probably entail a naval blockade that would keep Ukrainian grains from getting, and Ukrainian fertilizer for that matter, from getting out into the open markets by ship, and that those would essentially become Russian supplies if there's an actual, you know, annexed part of Ukraine come Monday, like they did with Russia and Crimea in 2014. The convoluted muddying part of this is the Chinese angle, and the angle of China supporting Russia, and China and Russia both having such a dominant, not just strong, but I'd say dominant foothold in the Middle East. And then that means energies. And so it would not be hard for me to see the energies and the wheat go lower, because the trade would have to maybe price in the idea that maybe those supplies are held hostage, but maybe the Western powers like Europe and the United States use food and agricultural commodities as a trade or political weapon if we do get into a conflict over there. And when I saw Germany reportedly take their quick reaction NATO troops up to the higher level this afternoon, and we know President Biden is going to be speaking soon, the words of the U.S. people that are looking at this in Washington, it looks, quote, dim in terms of a chance to avoid war. So I think that just brings more volatility to the market. It's not one of those straight up markets where you can just rely upon weather and supply, which we have plenty of that from the drought monitor.
In these kind of straight up markets, If you look back, usually it's straight up and straight down. There's not much of a tail on it. But this time around, it's a unique function, and maybe military action would cause exactly what you're talking about. And I don't know, do you think straight down? Or is there something else you've been watching? Or is, for instance, the drought and inflation supportive enough to build a base somewhere?
Yeah, I think that's where most paths for me, when it comes to these kind of geopolitical, and I'm not one because I didn't go to school for one, but I would classify my analysis as a global macro approach when it comes to commodity value levels. Supply-demand matter, weather matter, but they're with us every year. What makes the difference is the trade aspect of the demand, like what we saw with the phase one trade deal. Policy is really what changes things. And so I think policy and the dollar, if they work against us, it's going to be hard to fight that kind of momentum and that kind of tide, especially with, we're already starting to hear talk about the RFS, which is expiring in 2022 and coming up for review in 2023 about how it's, you know, ethanol's not as carbon friendly as it was, and Congress is already looking at that. So anything that you do to take prices up sharply, like we have, and then keep them elevated, is naturally going to work against you when it comes to policy and whether it's investment demand or real demand. So if the dollar would return as a safe haven, and all of a sudden next week, instead of being at 96 on the dollar, we're at 101 or 102, that can't be good news for the commodity bull.
What will you be watching on Monday night's trade?
Well, the biggest thing is going to be the dollar. I think the second thing will be the wheat, because the wheat has the most sensitive factor in this whole thing. I mean, look at Friday's close. We were able to go up and take out and make a new 2021 high in hard red wheat because the drought monitor, in my opinion, is what did it. The trade is finally realizing that the top eight states that make up about 65% of the winter wheat, and almost all of those states in hard red wheat country, those, all of those states are at least 90% drought at this point. And we're looking at a winter wheat crop that's in 71% drought versus 31 or 32 a year ago. I mean, it is bad. It is tragically bad out here west of me, Todd. And I think that's where the trade realizes that. So I think the battle lines are going to be drawn between the hard red wheat and the soft red wheat. And I'd watch that spread very carefully, because it looks like it's maybe even breaking out in favor of the hard red. And whoever wins that one, I think, takes the corn and beans with them. So I stick by what we've talked about, that if we want that next level in the beans, we need the wheat and the corn to help lead that way.
And that brings us back to the Russia-Ukraine issue, and what happens if Russia militarily invades Ukraine, a blockade goes into place of some kind, even I suppose if they don't invade, that keeps wheat from coming out of that country. And off of the marketplace, I suppose. So you have all of the Northern Hemisphere, or the bulk of it, then in real trouble as it relates to available supplies.
You do. And so then it goes back to how much did the Middle Eastern countries like Algeria and Egypt was tendering. I don't know if gas got their purchases made before this weekend, but you saw what happened in Algeria. They were initially going after 600,000 tons. My understanding is they went after 700,000 tons. So we don't know how much they bought forward, and that's the next step in the process. But all during this process, we're making an incredible run with the November bean price in terms of the crop insurance price. And we touched close to $6 in new crop corn. And so that's where I think all roads lead to profit per acre, regardless of what fundamental factors you're looking at. There are risk management tools out there and people that can help you, that can navigate through some of these things. And I think that's what the month of February and March is all about, especially given that not just Ukraine and Russia's next week, but we've got USDA's big baseline conference coming up too. We'll get some acreage numbers as well.
Yeah, that comes by the end of the week next week. We'll be watching those numbers very closely. As you said, risk management tools are what the months of February and March are about. And in this time, you're talking about crop insurance, but because the prices are so darn high, probably about some kind of marketing as well. What kind of plans do you have for producers?
These kind of revenue levels in beans especially, but even we're getting there in the corn, depending on what the fertilizer and what the chemicals like atrazine are going to be in terms of supply and cost. I think you can look at it from a standpoint that, you know, you need to obviously protect what you don't have insured. So if you take an 80% policy, that last 20% is really very much on the table to protect this next 30 days, especially if we would have a drought this year, because to me, the drought would hurt the corn a lot more than the soybeans, just because of the nature of the planting window that we have. And I think the second thing would be when we have these kind of price levels, to do paper positions and not do cash positions and let your basis do a lot of the heavy lifting if we would continue to have a drought. I think that needs to be thought about real seriously as well.
You have a good weekend. We'll talk with you next week and see you on the 8th day of March.
Looking forward to it, Todd. Looking forward to seeing all the great listeners.
That is Mike Zuzlow. He's at GlobalComResearch.com out of Atchison, Kansas, and will join us on the 8th day of March at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. We'll just cover one story for today's agricultural news. Avian influenza, highly pathogenic avian influenza, in fact, is showing up in poultry flocks located in multiple states. Dr. Shauna Voss is the senior veterinarian for poultry with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. And while avian influenza will show up in American poultry flocks, this strain is a step up from the typical viruses, she says.
Avian influenza itself is not unusual. It's commonly carried in wild waterfowl. And so we do occasionally have introductions of influenza into our poultry operations. What's different about what we're seeing this year is this is a highly pathogenic avian influenza, and it's a Eurasian strain. And so what's circulating in the U.S. now in wild waterfowl along the East Coast and what we're starting to see pop up in some domestic poultry populations is a strain that's very similar to what has been circulating in Europe the last few years. This is a very aggressive virus, and it's different than what we have normally seen in the past.
Voss says the number one thing poultry producers can do about avian influenza is trying to prevent it from getting into their flocks with a solid biosecurity plan. Voss says producers need to be vigilant and watch for signs of infection.
Avian influenza, in broad terms, can present itself in a lot of different ways. Low pathogenic avian influenza tends to have pretty mild symptoms in birds. Sometimes birds have some mild respiratory signs. You might see an egg production drop in egg-producing birds, a little bit of depression, and then they kind of bounce back. High pathogenic avian influenza is very devastating, and it affects the whole bird system and the whole body. And what producers are reporting with this strain is, first of all, they're seeing a drop in water consumption, and that's one of the first signs they see, followed by a pretty high mortality rate. And so either of those two signs in a flock means that somebody needs to be called, and we need to get some samples taken and tested for avian influenza.
And Voss says health officials in every state have protocols in place in case of infection.
First of all, that flock would get quarantined, and our first goal is, unfortunately, to put that flock down as quickly as possible. Birds don't survive highly pathogenic avian influenza, and so that's kind of our first course of action to try to prevent spread. We do establish a control area or a zone. It's a 10-kilometer zone around that infected farm where those farms also get quarantined, and we have additional surveillance and movement restrictions to try to make sure that we're not spreading the virus outside of where it was originally detected.
Avian influenza gets introduced from wild birds into domestic flocks in a couple of different ways.
Primarily, it's tracked into the barn, and so usually it's people or conveyances or equipment that are tracking it from the outside environment. And it's shed either through respiratory secretions or fecal secretions. Anytime that contaminates anything in the environment, and if those procedures aren't in place to help bring it into the barn, that's how we introduce it into flocks.
The veterinarian talks about a key to keeping avian influenza out of poultry flocks.
One of the things we're stressing right now is to make sure that every farm has a line of separation established. And that line of separation is either a physical or a functional line that protects your birds from the outside environment. Ultimately, if the virus can't cross that line and get into the birds, it can't affect your birds. And so making sure that those procedures are in place and that everybody who has to enter that barn and go in with those birds is following those every time. It's also important to see if there's ways that you can reduce the number of times anyone crosses that line of separation, just to reduce the chance that there be an error or you happen to introduce anything into the birds.
Again, that was Dr. Shauna Voss. She is with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, joined us courtesy of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Thanks to Chad Smith for putting together the program. For those of you that have backyard chickens, you need to pay attention as well, because this is one of the ways that avian influenza can be transferred. Be careful with those birds and make sure that you try to keep them as separate from the outside world as possible. Air Beef House event is just a couple of weeks away now, and if you've not picked up your tickets, today would be a great time to do that at 217-333-7300 during business hours, or at willag.org 24 hours a day. You can get yourself your tickets for the Beef House Spring Outlook that is sponsored in part by the Farm Dog team. We'll open our doors at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 in the Central Time Zone. Now, don't let that scare you in the AM, because really there's an hour there before we start. The program picks up at 8 o'clock in the Central Time Zone, 9 in the Eastern Time Zone. We do that for a reason. We like you to come and visit with the folks at the booth space around the outside of the conference. And, of course, there's coffee and rolls from the Beef House. Now, if you've not had those, they're good. They're worth coming over for the $25 alone. Well, maybe not for the $25, but, hey, you get Beef House lunch at the noon hour, too, for that. And the whole of the day, we'll kick off the morning with Scott Irwin and Joe Jansen, ag economists from the U of I. They'll talk about their view of the marketplace and some price outlook. Eric Snodgrass will be there. We'll talk with him in just a second as well. He's with Nutrient Ag Solutions and Agable. We'll do the weather for us, and then we'll have a Will Ag soybean panel with Ellen Dearden, Chip Nellinger, Merrill Crowley, Dave Chatterton, and Chuck Shelby, regulars that you hear on our air here at Illinois Public Media. We'll introduce the STAR program that has to do something with carbon markets. I've been working on the backside of that one for a while. It should be interesting to hear about. And then Gary Schnittke will join us to talk about crop insurance and crop budgets and all the things that you normally would hear from Gary. And you can always ask questions anytime you'd like throughout the day. We'll do the Beef House lunch, come back in the afternoon, talk about farm policy with Nick Paulson. We'll talk about the price of farmland with Bruce Sherrick. And then we'll have the corn panel with Matt Bennett, Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Mike Zuzlo, and Jackie Vakes. And we'll wrap up with a Q&A with all the folks in the afternoon. We'll be done by 3:30 in the Eastern Time Zone. That's 2:30 Central Time. We'll put you back in your trucks and cars, and you'll be on your way home. It's a great day. $25 for everything. Everything I just talked about, and you should join us on that day. In fact, Eric Snodgrass will be there, as you already heard, and he'll help us get things kicked off in the morning. Eric, it's always great to have you over at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. And I'm so looking forward to having you there again this year.
Yeah, I always look forward to it, and I'm ready for that March weather, too.
Well, As I said, I hope we can order some better weather than we've had, although it depends on whether you like snow. Yesterday was really rough, and I'm told, is that just kind of round one in the Midwest of snow again?
Yeah, it was round one, and I kind of feel like we lost, because that winter storm that came through, I thought it was going to be quite a bit more rain and sleet at first, but it quickly went over to snow, and we picked up. I mean, my forecast was for 4 inches where I live in Mahomet, and I had it well over six on my driveway. And yeah, that was just the beginning. So right now, we need to start looking to the northwest. There's another system that's curling down through the Pacific Northwest. It's going to go through the Great Basin this weekend, shows up in the plains next Monday night, next Tuesday, and it comes right across the same track. And we're looking at another, you know, chance for getting some snow and rain out ahead of it, just like this last one. And next week is also round three. So there's a third system that's coming behind all of it that's going to hit us. And the problem is, from the Mid-South all the way to New England, we're talking about an excess of 4 inches of rain compared to average where we are. You know, it's almost like we've just forgotten that November, December, and January did not deliver any snow, right? And all of a sudden now we're above average and it's been incredibly snowy. So if you've missed out on winter, it's back in full force. And it's certainly putting moisture back in the ground, but it's also running off a lot because we're frozen 5 inches to 18 inches. And so this is the big problem with these next three systems.
Yeah, so it'll be running off. There'll be a lot of flood warnings. I know I'm headed towards Indiana for a few things this weekend, and they were under flood warnings last night because of this storm. And you're right about November, December, and January, of course. I don't know whether there's any data to support this, but usually we pay for something like that.
It feels that way.
It sure does feel that way. Probably better talk about March as well. Do things turn different in that month?
Well, you know, usually we say March comes in like a lion, right? But I think February is going to go out like, you know, a whole zoo full of lions. And then maybe March comes in with a better outlook. And right now, while I'm not worried about us having a dry March, more mild days could be in store. Now, listen, before we get there, we have some brutally cold Arctic air coming in at the end of February. But March right now is looking for more days warmer than average and possibly a little bit more rain. So that's the newest outlook. It's supported by the CPC and NOAA and also some long-range forecast models that we look at every day. So I think March is going to be one where we're not going to be worrying about drought here, but maybe drought elsewhere in the country.
Oh, I can hardly wait to hear about that in detail at the Spring Outlook when you present on the 8th day of March. By the way, people can get their tickets for $25 online at willag.org or dial 217-333-7300. South America has been hardcore all winter long as it's related to the weather and the impact on the marketplace. Are things changing at all there?
You know, they are kind of changing a little bit. What's happening here over the next 15 days is that the northern growing areas, which have had, to be honest, a pretty darn good growing season so far, and we've seen the harvest progress, we've seen the planting progress of spring of crop, well, they're going to look at a dry, about 10-day time period starting next week. While that happens, southern Brazil, which was an exceptional drought, is going to finally get some rain. But I don't want anyone to hear me say that and think that that's going to undo the damage that was done, because we're too late in the season for a lot of that crop for this to really help. What it might help is the safrinha crop growing in. But I got to be honest, I'm still concerned about the monsoon shutting down a little early this year, which could impact the end of that safrinha crop. So I guess if you want me to put an idea to it, I'm neutral to lower going forward on how things are going to shape up in South America.
Why are you concerned about the safrinha crop? What is it in the weather someplace else on the planet that has you thinking cautiously?
You got it. There's two things. The La Nina continues to fade, and as it fades, it's letting the MJO take over. So this is why I'm concerned. Right now, over the next 10 days, the MJO goes to phase five. Why we care about that is phase five slows the monsoon down. It takes about 6 weeks to complete the loop, which means it could be back into phase five once we get into April. And if it's there in April, well, that's the end of the monsoon anyway. It could shut it down a bit early, and that would be like us not getting the rain we need in late August for the crop to finish. So I think that's the main concern, and it'll be something I'll be watching and talking about on March 8th, that's for sure.
Well, that'll be fantastic. By the way, the 8th day of March is a Tuesday. That's the Spring Outlook Day at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. Day-long event. 10 of our regular panelists, Eric Snodgrass, will be there, as you just heard, along with the Farm Doc team, the agricultural economists, folks like Gary Schnitke and Scott Irwin, Joe Jansen, Nick Paulson, and others. Bruce Sherrick will be there as well to talk about the price of farmland. On the 8th day of March, you should be as well. You can get your tickets right now at willag.org. Or dial 217-333-7300 during regular business hours. That's 217-333-7300. Or online at willag.org for all the details. Buy your tickets for the Spring Outlook right now. And we'll see you on Tuesday, the 8th day of March. We'll see you too, Eric. And oh, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Eric Snodgrass. He's with Nutrien Ag Solutions and Agribull. Joined us here on the Closing Market Report for this Friday afternoon. Stay with us. Commodity Week is coming up next with our guest Wayne Nelson, Merrill Crowley, and Kurt Kimmel.